I put up on the board to ask me about my Bible, and in light of all the things that were coming in the prayer list, a little levity probably is inappropriate, but we're going to do it anyway. Some of you may be aware that the Bible I've been carrying for the last little while is not the one I have normally used. I had gotten the Bible that I did normally use in such shape that it was falling apart, so I fixed it with duct tape. And it was suggested on several occasions that I turn it over to a group. In fact, there were librarians at the place where I work who were ready to take it and send it out to a binding company locally. And I never would let it go because I was afraid I wouldn't get it back. Or if I got it back, it wouldn't be in the same shape it was when I sent it. Another friend noted that he had had his Bible, which was also fixed with duct tape, rebound through some folks that they knew in Africa. And it was rebound in Impala leather. And didn't I want to have mine done, they would take care of it well. So I sent my Bible overseas 9 months ago. Sometime around Thanksgiving, word came that the Bible had been lost in a civil war in Zimbabwe. No one knew where it was and hadn't had the nerve to tell me. And they finally told me 6 weeks after it was lost when it finally resurfaced. But it was still in Africa, and with all the turmoil over there, it didn't look like it was going to get back anytime soon. That's the duct tape cover, which came back this morning. And this is the Bible, which came back this morning. It appears to be perfect, and it's now bound in warthog. So, all my... all my notes, all my bookmarks, all the other things that I normally depend on and have been doing without for 9 months, I have them back. So I just thought I'd share that with you. I didn't have this at 9:30. It came in between the two classes. So,
open it up in this.
I'll start using it next week.
It's kind of savory.
Maybe two or three of you can tell the other jokes. If you want to pass it around, that's okay. But I do want you to pay attention to what we're doing in here a little bit. We have been looking for a little while at characteristics of servants as shown in sentences in the New Testament. A guy named T.W. Hunt put this list together. He said that the word servant appears in the New Testament 14 times with a modifier, some kind of an adjective or a description of a characteristic of that servant. We're not talking about Jesus functioning as a servant. We're talking about followers of the Lord functioning as servants. And we've had a chance now to go through seven of these, and 7 of these. And we hit a verse in the New Testament that had four more characteristics in one verse and a fifth characteristic in the verse, the two verses that immediately followed. And so a couple of weeks ago I gave you the assignment of looking at that verse and of thinking about the characteristics that were there. So this is pop quiz time. If you haven't been here for a couple of weeks, you're off the hook. What was the verse you're supposed to have looked at? 2 Timothy? 2:24, four characteristics in there, and then a couple more right afterwards. So if you can find that, and what I want to do is I'd like to read starting in verse 22. If you can find 2 Timothy 2, let me start reading in verse 22. Genuine warthog instead of synthetic warthog, I noticed.
The real deal. Just the real deal.
some of you have seen Randy Trail and Kitty Trail mentioned on the prayer list. Randy has one that's bound in elephant's hide or elephant leather somehow. And I thought that would be thick, but somehow it's fairly thin. But okay, 2 Timothy 2, chapter 2, verse 22. Turn away from the passions of youth. Concentrate on uprightness, faith, love, and peace in union with all those who call on the Lord with a pure heart. Avoid those foolish and undisciplined speculations, understanding that they only give rise to quarrels. And now the verse we're focused on. And a servant of the Lord must not engage in quarrels, but must be kind to everyone, a good teacher, and patient. Verse 25, he must be gentle when he corrects people who oppose him, in the hope that God may give them a change of mind so that they recognize the truth and come to their senses, escaping the trap of the devil who made them his captives and subjected them to his will. Now,
if you ever go and purchase markers for a dry erase board, I just want to give you a little clue. If you see down at the end of it where it says low odor, it might as well say just below it, won't erase. Because that sort of amounts to the same thing. We discovered this at the university. We switched to whiteboards and there's markers that won't erase, and we finally figured out the thing that's characteristic and common is if it says low odor, it's going to be a real pain to erase. So, in deference to the folks that enjoy seeing these using different colors, I will use different colors, but then we'll have to work on erasing them afterwards. So last week we looked at the first of these, not quarrelsome. And what I'd like to do is get the other four in this group of five. The reason there's an eight here is that we've had seven of these now, five are together in one place. And the reason the eight is up there is because that looked like a good place to put it. But the reason this is down here was we didn't get a race last week, and so the black fit into what was left over from last week a little better if we put it there. None of that matters. What's the ninth one? This is the one that's the second item. We're looking at verse 24. A servant of the Lord must not engage in quarrels, but must be, and my translation uses the word kind. Now, gentle. I think King James uses the word gentle, and I want to make sure if there's any other term that we see it. What other terms do you see? Is there any other term that you see in here? Okay.
A servant of the Lord must not engage in quarrels, but must be kind to everyone, comma. Mine says a good teacher.
Able to teach. Yours says able to teach. Can you see if I write with orange? Now, I think we came this far last week, far enough to have made this list, so this is in part of repetition last week. Able to teach in contrast to what?
Teachable.
Teachable applies to students or pupils. Able to teach applies to teachers. Okay. So, able to teach applies to teachers. Teachable applies to students. Let's go one more.
Patient.
Uh-huh. Mine says and patient.
So yours has that same term here, huh?
Not reasonable.
Yeah, my translation says patient, but I don't think that's a particularly good rendering of that. Yours says not resentful. Another translation says forbearing. That's F-O-R-E, bearing, right? I remember having a half an hour discussion with somebody about whether it has an E or doesn't have an E.
It doesn't in my Bible. Sorry. That was...
Okay. Anybody else? There is one more translation out there, and I haven't heard it yet. Yours is the message, huh?
Well, I wrote it down from last week, so...
Cool. There's a modifier for patient in a couple of translations, and it's a real good one. Patient.
When...
wrong. And if you notice, that then starts to make not resentful and forbearing actually does work with that. The word patient by itself doesn't work quite as well as when you have that modifier on. My translation doesn't have that, and I think to that degree it's incomplete. Now that I have this Bible back, wherever it is, don't keep it. I would hate to get it back and then lose the first hour I had it. I'll make a note in there about that. I've been listening to a book. I own the book, but it's a whole lot easier to find time to learn what the book says by listening to the book. I've got the book on audio tape checked out of the Chesapeake County Library. So the book sits on the shelf, and when I drive back and forth to work, I'll listen to a few minutes of this. And some of you know about this. It's a biography of Lincoln's dealings with his cabinet coming into and during the Civil War. I do not think I've ever read about anybody who displayed that characteristic any more than what I read about Lincoln. It seems like every time you turn around, somebody's doing something or saying something that slanders him or puts him looking like he's wrong, and he had such patience and gentleness with that. He seemed to know how to respond, not to retaliate, how to respond in a way that brought positives out of what otherwise would be negatives, and the kind of political infighting that seems to characterize our world. He seemed to have a way of saying just a sentence or two or three and damping everything out, and keeping people focused on important things and not letting them focus on the things. Something like that is what they're talking about, I think. And then the fifth one is found as you move into verse 25. My translation says he must be gentle, so the word that C.W. Hunt uses up here, my translation uses down here. Where's another color I can use? Low odor red. He uses the word gentle again, but other translations will have something else. What's your sense?
Meek.
Uh-huh. And that's what T.W. Hunt has. He has meek there. Somebody, you were saying something.
Are you looking at 25?
When I go across.
Gently instructive.
Yeah, because it's connecting with another word that's a little bit later. Mine says he must be gentle when he corrects people who do that. So gentle in correction.
Mine's just correcting opponents with gentleness.
Uh-huh. Correcting, gentle when he corrects people who oppose him.
Mm-hmm. So correction in humility.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's what T.W. Hunt is picking up, is meek or gentle in that sense, but in this context.
Humble takes it all in.
Yeah. The problem for us is that humble was number one on our list, and we're down to number eight or number ten. So I'm pointing out to you, we're in essence making a repetition here of a word, but the terms do not mean the same thing. And so if you use the word humble down here, it is appropriate, but you're going to have to make a little distinction with the item that we talked about earlier on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially these 8 through 12, all are covered in Paul's description of what love is in 1 Corinthians 13.
I'm wondering when somebody would notice that. Yeah, they are.
It's interesting.
Exactly so.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think he does reverse this one.
That's one, yeah.
I think he reverses this one. Yes, ma'am.
Back on number 9, I had written down my sweet gentle listener, which makes it a little different from gentle and correction.
Gentle listener. One thing I want to say as we start to move into this. The word that we are using as the word that all these terms modify is the word servant. Churches have used for some time now, and it's biblically very sound, the term servant leadership. A little while back, I put together a small group that I'm part of now, and these are some guys that I got together because I admire some things about the way they do things, and I figure I've got things to learn. And so it's sort of an accountability group for me. And one of the things that has happened as we've
progressed in meeting together and talking and discussing is that we became concerned about a very specific thing in the church, which is how does this church, the more general question is how does any church, transition from the leadership of older people to the leadership of younger people. And so this began to be something we talked about enough that we went in and asked Travis and Kaki Adlock, who's in charge of the discipleship area, to come and meet with us. And we've talked about this quite a bit. I think it's coincidence. Maybe it's not, but I think it's coincidence because I don't think there's been enough time. But you will have noticed in the worship this morning that the pastor is beginning a series on leadership. And I would encourage you to begin to think about the characteristics we're doing in the context of what he's talking about with leadership, because I think the two connect. There's a phrase that we've seen in the book that we're reading, leadership as service, and service by being a leader. Service by leading, and leading by serving. And I think the connection between these two things is stronger than I realized. I didn't know the pastor was going to start this series this morning, but I encourage you to begin to look at those two things side by side. Now, the one that we want to focus on this morning is this one, but I do want to talk about this just a little bit. Let me make sure that everybody heard this. This term is able to teach. And what's the companion term that is up there? Teachable. Okay? Teachable applies to, you said, students or pupils, and able to teach applies to teachers. And since I'm a teacher and have been for a while, I want to talk just a little bit about some of the dynamics of that, just to get you ready for that discussion a couple of weeks from now. At the first meeting of the first class I teach at the university, I teach several different classes, but the upper level classes have earlier courses as prerequisites, so the course that everything starts with. When I teach that, the first day of class, I talk to my students and I say, I'm going to be asking you questions. And when I ask you questions, you're going to give me responses. How would you characterize the kind of responses my students might give me to the questions I pose to them? They might reveal by their response that they're clueless. They might say, I don't know, or they might just, that is one response, and I get it regularly. Okay. When they give that response, they have revealed something. What have they revealed? They revealed their ignorance. They have not revealed their stupidity. They have revealed their ignorance. What's the difference? Ignorance means a lack of knowledge. Stupidity means a lack of an ability to gain knowledge. If they weren't ignorant of the subject I was teaching, why would they be in the course? They wouldn't need the course, right? So I tell them, you know, ignorance is okay. I don't want to replace that with something. However, I am on a campaign now, and I do not know the people to contact, but I'm going to work on this. I want to contact the people who handle the advertisement for Staples. Staples markets a little thing about this big around. It's red on top, and it's got silver letters. And when you push it, a little mechanical voice says, that was easy. Okay? I want a companion one that when I push it, it says, that was stupid. And I can see the ad. Somebody goes and buys their office supplies at someplace other than Staples, finds out how much they could have saved at Staples, and presses the button. That was stupid. And that button turns out to have many uses. I have very few times during the week. I've thought about buying one of those, but I realized I have very few times during the week that anything I do is easy. You know, there's almost no time I can press a button, except sarcastically. You know, press it, that was easy, when everybody in the room knows it was not. But the that is stupid button, I can use that. I've got, heck, yesterday, two times. Today, once, already. Okay. Second observation, still on this thing. What could students say in response to me? One thing they could say is a revelation that they don't know something. What else could they give in response?
Another question.
They could pose a question in return. Okay? What else?
The wrong answer.
They can give me the wrong answer, and if they can give me the wrong answer, they could give me the...
Right.
And then they could give me the wrong answer, the right answer, or
something
that has partly right and partly wrong. Let me work with those three for just a moment. If somebody gives me a wrong answer, what do I need to do? Number 12. I need to gently. Correct. Now, this isn't an opponent situation. This is not the same. But if you can understand that. I don't want to really, I want to gently bring them to correctness. But when a student gives me a response, do they know that they're giving me a right response as opposed to a wrong response? Sometimes, yeah, but most of the time, no. So when they offer a response that's right, how is it offered? Tentatively. With a rise of the voice at the end that makes it sound like a question and a cringing right after offering it just in case abuse is coming. Right? So what do I need to do then? I need to celebrate that there's been a right answer given. I need to applaud. I need to do things to celebrate. And what happens when it's right, part right and part wrong? I need to celebrate the part that's right, gently correct the part that's wrong, and try to work them together and settle for all trouble. Isn't this fun? Now, here's my question. What kind of teacher was Paul? What kind of teacher was Paul? I draw your attention to Galatians chapter 3, verse 1. Look it up. And if yours has a translation that has the word foolish early, you don't have the best translation. You need a newer translation or a different translation, at least at that point. Or you need to pencil in a different translation in the margin. Galatians 3, verse 1. Oh, you foolish Galatians, that is not strong enough. My translation at this point says, and I quote, "You stupid people in Galatia, how could you?" And then it goes on from there.
What's the chapter?
Chapter 3, verse 1 of Galatians.
Crazy Galatians.
Yeah. Have you lost your minds? There are times when even a very good teacher like Paul was doesn't follow all the rules of how good teachers ought to behave. Okay. Now, there's lots of other things that can happen. Somebody can give you an answer that has nothing to do with the question you're asking. They still think they're answering the question, but it has nothing to do with it. They can ask your question with a question which is evasive. And some people are very good at this. Well, that makes me wonder so-and-so, and then, you know, puts you back on it. But as you work with this, you realize the way that you teach has an effect on how your students learn. But there's more to it than that. About, I don't know, 25 years ago, I was teaching general chemistry. At that time, we taught a year-long course in general chemistry. I had a student, first semester, a young lady. She finished the semester and barely made a B. Did not take the second semester, disappeared, didn't see her, she was gone. Virginia Commonwealth hired me to teach summer school general chemistry. I walked in on my first day, I set my books on the lecture table, and I looked up. The room would eventually have about 35 or 40 people in it. It had one in the room at that moment. That student sitting on the front row looked up just as I looked up. It was the young lady from my class. She turned white as a sheet. She said, as I recall, "Oh my God." And after a moment of silence, as she recovered a little bit of her composure, she said, "What do I do?" And I said, "What are you here to do?" "I'm here to learn chemistry. I've got to learn this. I've got things I want to do that this is the foundation for." And I said, "Well, I'm here to teach. Let's see how it works." Okay. She made a B+ in the first semester. She made an A- in the second semester. Late in the second semester, I asked her a question. I said, "What was the difference?" She said, "You were." Back last year, you gave examples that made no sense. Everything was disorganized. Nothing followed from anything else. This summer, you have given illustrations that make perfect sense. Everything follows one thing from another. You have changed completely the way you teach.
glad you think that. But it's you who's changed. Sometimes students are teachable and it doesn't work the first time. Sometimes teachers are able to teach and it doesn't work the first time. Sometimes the first time is all you get, and then you got a little tragedy on your hands. Years later, people say, well, I never could learn chemistry. It's the hardest thing I've ever heard. Okay. God's servants need to be good teachers. Have you ever thought of that for yourself? This isn't pulling out a hierarchy. This is saying all of God's servants ought to be good teachers. They ought to be gentle and kind. They ought to be good listeners. And they ought to be good teachers. There's a place in Hebrews, I didn't remember to say this in the first hour, there's a place in Hebrews where he says, you're still waiting on milk, spiritual milk, when by now you ought to be eating solid food. In fact, you ought to not just be eating solid food, you ought to be feeding others the meat of spiritual food. He's talking about the same thing. There comes a point in the progress of a Christian that the discipleship brings you from where you're a learner to where you become a teacher. I got a clue for you. Nobody is ever a teacher and not still a learner. Just in case you don't know that. But you begin to be able to pass on to others. That's what he's talking about. Yeah. Do you remember the verse right before? Don't get caught up in foolish and undisciplined speculations, understanding that they only give rise to quarrels. A servant of the Lord must not engage in quarrels. He must instead be kind to everyone, even the ones who want to fight. And he must be a good teacher, looking for ways to get across the things that God has made clear or plain to her or to him. And then what does it say? Patient. And this one says, patient in wrong. And then what does the next one say? Gentle in the correction of people who are opposing you. Even if they're not. Now, what holds all of this together? It's the humility that we started with back up front. And I want to make that point as well as I can in a little bit of time we have left. Talking only about this. And we're going to come back every week. We're going to list all these because I think they're a set that fits together. But we're going to apply it to this one because I want for this one to put the attitude, but more importantly, I want you to see what this enables God to do. If this characteristic comes into your life, then God is able to use that and do things. And that's the part I want you to see. So I want to take you to Luke chapter 22. We got time to do this, and we got time to do little else. Luke chapter 22. And I want you to pay attention to the way this thing is worded, and I want you to pay attention to how this is worded very, very carefully, because there's some surprises in here. Even if you've read this before, if you have not read it carefully, you might miss some things. Okay? There's a huge contrast between verse 31 and verse 28. I want you to look at verse 28, and then we're going to focus on verse 31 and following. Verse 28, Jesus says to his disciples, you are the men who have stood but faithfully by me in my trials. And now I confer a kingdom on you just as my Father conferred one on me. You will eat and drink at my table in the kingdom, and you will sit on thrones to judge the 12 tribes of Israel. Verse 31. Look at the wrenching contrast to what just came before. Simon, Simon, look, Satan has got his wish to sift you all like wheat. But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And once you have recovered, you in your turn must strengthen your brothers. Satan got his wish. Going to sift like wheat. Who's he going to sift like wheat? Read it again. And I'm not sure your translation has this, but I think it's correct. Listen to my translation. If yours doesn't have it, you can at least pencil this in with a question mark. Simon, Simon, look, Satan has got his wish to sift you all like wheat. This is a plural structure, I'm told, not a singular structure. Satan has got his wish to sift you all like wheat. But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And once you have recovered, I think there's one translation that says been restored. then you in your turn must strengthen your brothers. Okay?
You mean, Bill, you think when they say, I pray for you all, this is also being plural?
I think that one's singular. At least that's what I'm told.
In my Bible, it says other plural.
Does it?
I pray for you in the particular.
I'm told that that implication is there. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know.
In verse 32, it says it goes to singular, but the two in verse 31 are
okay, okay. Now, here's what I want you to sense. Look back at verse 28. Jesus is talking to all of his disciples, right? All of his disciples. And what does he say to them? You stood by me faithfully in all my trials. But the biggest trial of all, the crucifixion, is about to come. And what happens to the disciples when that comes? All but John scatter. And we think maybe that's because John was so young he wasn't perceived as a threat by the soldiers. They all scatter. Satan has got his wish. He's going to sift you like wheat. And then he singles Simon out through this thing and says, I am praying for you that your faith may not fail. And that once you have recovered, once you have been restored, you in your turn must strengthen the brothers. You see the little in your turn? What was the key to Simon's recovery, to his restoration? You in your turn must strengthen your brothers. What happened to Simon? You in your turn must strengthen your brothers. He's been strengthened. And as he's strengthened, he turns around and helps the next one. The strengthening doesn't come because of his qualities other than his faith. And what does faith mean? The ability to keep your eye on God even when you're doing everything wrong. Even when you're pressing that button over and over again. That was stupid, that was stupid, that was stupid. Look at the rest of this little section. Lord Peter answered, I'm ready to go to prison with you. I'm ready to go to death with you. And Jesus replied, I tell you, Peter, by the time the cock crows today, it's after midnight, you will have denied three times that you even know me. What attitude does Peter have at this moment?
No.
At this moment, what attitude does he have? Pride. By the time the night is over and he realizes what he's done, Scripture says he goes out and cries bitter tears. Two of Jesus' disciples were crying bitter tears that next day. One was Peter, one was Judas. Peter was restored, Judas wasn't. Why? Simon had a faith that kept his eye on God through failures. And God used that to do what?
That attitude allows God, frees God, to strengthen. And when God strengthens us, what's supposed to happen next? We're supposed to start working with God to strengthen other people. So that the strengthening of others comes through the experience we have. God takes a breaking to turn us into people who can do it. The pride and the arrogance is taken away.
I stay with it just a little longer. That your faith may not fail, my translation says. Does Simon realize he's screwed up the next day when he's denied Jesus three times? You bet. And realize Jesus knew it before it happened. And yet, Jesus said, I've prayed for you. Could Judas have been restored? I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is yes. But he didn't keep his eye on God in the same way. Lots of times people do things that make them press the button. That was stupid. And sometimes the button needs to be the size of this room. Can God use you on the other side of that? He can if you keep your eye on him through that. Or if you remember it afterwards, which I think maybe is closer to truth for Simon. Whenever you hear anybody say, God can't possibly use that person, look what they've done. be careful. Part of that's true. Sometimes the things we do block us from certain kinds of service and limit the kinds of service that we can give. But God can always use His faithful children in some place. More than anything else, I think that's what he's talking about. Let me tell you what T.W. Hunt gives for the attitude that's in the middle. Deference that enhances the work of others for the master. Once Simon had fallen, he came back with a different attitude towards other people. I was broken. I was a failure where God was concerned, and God restored me. You know what? Maybe you're a failure too, but God can restore you too. There was a point after Judas committed suicide. The disciples got together and said, there's 11 of us. There ought to be 12. We need a 12th. They nominated two people, rolled some dice, and says, okay, you're it, and we never hear that person again. What if God had been consulted rightly at that moment? You know what I think he would have said? I want Saul of Tarsus to be the 12th. And what would the disciples have said? Have you lost your mind? He's not one of us. He hasn't been part of any of this. What do you mean you want him? What do you read about Paul? I was the chief of sinners. If God can bring me and restore me, he can restore anybody. Hiding in this one, I think, is the heart of the most important parts of the New Testament. God brings us to the point where we can begin to recognize that God can use anybody around us. And we begin to be aware of that and begin to take part in enabling that to happen. I think that's the strengthening of others that he calls on Peter to do. And I think that's why T.W. Hunt took us to that verse. That's enough time. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the days that come. We realize that sometimes what comes in those days are trials that hardly seem bearable. But through those trials, whether no fault of our own, as some of the illnesses are that we've talked about on the board, or the accidents, or whether it's because we've just been stupid, we haven't listened to you, we haven't followed you. Whatever the trials that come, help us realize that your love for us is permanent, unwavering, and that you call us into your service, and that part of what you call us into is working with you to call others. Help us understand how important it is for us to realize what you have done for us and to let that be the foundation on what we build, what we do for you, the gratitude we have for your action in our hearts and in our lives. We pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.